you've ever found yourself asking, can the president do that? It's not a rhetorical question. It's a question of civics, and it's a question we explore over this next hour with our expert guest, David Schultz. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. Larry will be back tomorrow, but David Schultz, our guest this hour, answering your questions about presidential power, war powers, and the current power of the U.S. Constitution as it now stands. David Schultz is a distinguished university professor of political science and legal studies at Hamline University. He's also a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas School of Law and a professor at the Lithuanian Military Academy. He's the author of a constitutional law textbook with its third edition on the way. And David Schultz, thank you so much for joining us today on The Larry Mueller Show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you have questions for our guest, you can join the conversation at any time at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And David, let's start with the U.S. Constitution and what it has to say about our the power to wage war. How did our forefathers decide who gets what power and why?
Well, we have to think us back to American history in 1776, the Declaration of Independence, and in 1787, the writing of the Constitution. And as I like to say to my students, and I write this on the board the very first day, I say, our framers were scared of what? Had fear of strong executive power. We fought an American Revolution because we didn't like kings with all kinds of powers and doing whatever they want, including the power to what? Wage war on their own. Because what? The King of England waged war against us. So when we wrote the Constitution, or I say our framers wrote the Constitution, they lodged the bulk of the military powers in the hands of Congress. And for our purposes, the most important clause to look at is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the Constitution. And it says the power to declare war resides with Congress. Now, they have other powers about the raising and supporting armies and the military and so forth. But the primary responsibility for, I'll call it declarations of war, war-making power, is with Congress. On the other hand, Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution makes the president commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And the classic division of labor that we used to think about is Congress declares war once and funds military, funds the armies. Once it's declared, the president is now the civilian commander of the armed forces and gets to what? Oversee the military. That's supposed to be the division of labor.
And Professor Schultz, when we look at where we stand today, we have not declared war. And in past military use of the military to defend the United States, we have lacked a declaration of war. But we have also used our military in a way that would suggest this would be anything as like a war without calling it as such. So how did we get to this gray area where declarations aren't made, but military attacks are used?
Well, it's a great question here. And in the entire history of the United States, we've only had five declarations of war. The last time we actually formally had a declaration of war was World War II. And so I don't know, for example, if there are any still Korean War vets out there. Korean War was not a war. Declared war. Vietnam was not a declared war. The war on terrorism, Iraq, none of these declared wars. Now, in all those situations, we had something called resolutions where Congress sort of said, yeah, we're going to let you do this in the case of Vietnam. And there may be some Vietnam War vets out there that remember this. We had what's called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution that authorized the president to use force to protect the United States. For those who are veterans of the in Afghanistan and so forth, we had the authorization to use military force by Congress, but again, not formal declarations of war. So in many situations, what's happened is that Congress has said, okay, not a formal declaration of war, but go ahead. You have our blessing to go do things. And in some situations, presidents have used force for defensive purposes. Nobody disagrees with the idea that if the United States was attacked, the president has to be able to react. But here, the Iran war, first off, what's that old phrase? It looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, or something like that. I mean, here, what, bullets are flying, bombs are dropped. I've lost track now. Well, I think it's at least 12 U.S. military casualties, maybe more at this point, plus wounded. It certainly looks and feels like a war, but we neither have a formal declaration of war nor a congressional resolution. And this is what makes it totally unprecedented in American history, is that a president has dragged us into or put us into a combat situation that was not defensive. Now, I know the president has tried to say that Iran was ready to attack us or we had to respond. Again, no evidence to support that. We weren't facing enemy attack. But that's put us unusual. But the simple answer is that over time, Congress has gradually acceded or conceded, I'm not sure what word I'm looking for here, and has let presidents deploy troops more and more for all types of purposes. And so it's been kind of this gradual erosion of congressional authority and gradual assumption of presidential authority when it comes to what I'm going to call war-making powers that has put us to where we are right now.
So we've taken a look at the executive branch, the presidency, and the ability to declare war, which hasn't been done since World War II. We've taken a look at the congressional branch and how up until what's happening right now in Iran, they have in some way given the okay for the president to become the commander-in-chief as dictated in Article 2, Section 2. But David Schultz, what do the courts say about the division of war powers among the branches of government?
For the most part, what the Supreme Court has said is leave us alone. what I mean by that is they've said that questions of war and peace are questions that we're going to leave to what they call the political branches, Congress and the president. Because during the Vietnam War, there were several court cases in which people were challenging the Vietnam War and saying it's an illegal war, or especially those who are subject to the draft conscription, who are saying that, hey, I'm being drafted into a war that's unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court basically said, we're not going to address that matter. Leave it up to Congress and the president to work out. So for the most part, the courts have said this is not an issue for us to get involved in. And you political branches need to do your job instead.
When I look at what's happening now with military actions against Iran, I've seen comparisons made to May 2022 when President Biden approved the deployment of several hundred U.S. troops in Somalia. I've seen, without any sort of congressional approval, I've seen comparisons made to the President Obama's use of drones to attack terrorist camps. How do these presidential actions using our military compare to you, Professor Schultz?
I actually think they're pretty much the same thing, that maybe this is quantitatively different, but when we deploy troops overseas, it could have been, for example, which was it the first Bush that we went into Panama to get Noriega, if I remember correctly, if I remember on this one, or drone attacks across the world. This is all occurring with presidents without any authorization from Congress. And this is important to understand here, because I would say that this has been a, if I can call it, a bipartisan problem. You know, with just the most recent presidents, we're looking at Trump, Biden, and Obama. They have deployed troops or used force in ways that are without congressional authorization and in ways that are not based upon, let's say, defensive purposes. I mean, yeah, there might be bad guys who are part of Al-Qaeda across the world or something like that. But unless they were actually attacking us or imminently ready to attack us, going out there and deploying troops or bombs or drones or whatever doesn't seem consistent with what the our constitutional framers had envisioned the division of labor to be.
So what we're seeing with Iran right now isn't so much an unprecedented event as an escalation, at, perhaps in scope, of what we have seen across administrations among both parties, and the failure of Congress to act or at least interject in what you point out they have the constitutional ability to do if they so choose.
Yes, they could. For example, during the Vietnam War, there were many people who said that what Congress should do is either revoke the resolution, or they could just simply say, we're not going to fund it. We're not going to appropriate money for the Vietnam War and end it. So they have, again, a lot of authority, because, again, we only talked about the declaration of war. You know, but again, among the other Article 1, Section 8 powers that Congress has, it says that what? Raise and support armies, provide and maintain the Navy, provide for calling out of the militia. There's actually a lot of clauses there. So Congress has many tools at its disposal. But you're hitting at an important issue here, because coming out of the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, again, Johnson goes to Congress and says, we were attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin, one of our ships, by North Vietnamese. I want authority to be able to protect us. Congress issues the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and eventually both Johnson and then Nixon use that for what? Eventually an escalation to where we had almost 500,000 troops deployed in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. After the Vietnam War ended, there was an effort to try to bridge what some people call this gray area between congressional and presidential power. And we adopted what's called the War Powers Act, or the War Powers Resolution. And what the War Powers Act said is that presidents would have temporary authority to deploy troops for 60 days across the world for a variety of reasons. They have to consult with Congress, and they have to notify Congress of this. But then at any time, Congress could pass a resolution saying, nope, bring the troops home, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what's happened is that the War Powers Resolution, again, was an area to try to bridge this overlap between congressional versus presidential power. For the most part, presidents have ignored it. They have said, well, we're going to tell Congress we're doing something, not because we have to, not because of the War Powers Act, but simply what we're going to do it out of the goodness of our heart or something. So what was supposed to be an effort to try to, again, if I can call it that gray area, has largely failed. And this is part of a broader picture, war powers, that I would call a problem that the U.S. historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called the rise of the imperial presidency. Yeah. That if we fought a revolutionary war to limit executive power, at least since the time of the second Roosevelt, maybe as early as Lincoln, you know, with the Civil War, we have seen this gradual accumulation of power in the presidency. And in the early 70s, again, the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, if we don't do something, we're going to basically create an imperial presidency. And so giving presidents this kind of power, even if you happen to be a supporter of Donald Trump, or you liked Obama, or you liked Biden, it goes against, I think, what our framers were fearful of, is giving what? A president too much power over taking this country into war over matters of war and peace.
And this makes that makes this a discussion not about politics or political persuasion, but rather about civics and where we see the powers to wage war, which would be something you would think we would want to have well defined. And yet, as our guest, Professor David Schultz, has laid out for us this afternoon, appears unclear, with plenty of gray areas to move, regardless of party or political persuasion. And maybe you have some questions about the rise of, or the warning of the rise of, the imperial presidency, and where these powers now stand, and what that means for our current use of the military in Iran, and what we can expect going forward among the division of powers and the three branches of our federal government. If you have questions, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email us talk@wpr.org. We'll continue with our guest, distinguished university professor of political science and legal studies at Hamline University, David Schultz, next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, and for 2 hours from 11 to 1, it's all about better health. He'll start with a look at the importance of advanced care planning. After that, we'll take a look at the latest treatments for osteoporosis, and finally, the dangers of blastomycosis, breathing in this fungus from the soil, and how it can be potentially fatal if untreated. It's all coming up tomorrow with Larry Mueller here from 11 to 1. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is David Schultz, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at Hamline University, Law Professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, Professor at the Lithuanian Military Academy, and we're taking a look at the war powers, the president's powers, and the power of the U.S. Constitution as it defines such. Let's go to Dan in Elkhorn next. Dan, good afternoon.
Hi there. My question was, even if we do in the midterms, the Democrats manage to take over the House and the Senate, and they would put in something that was a little bit more powerful, restrictive than the War Powers Act, the enforcement entity would be the military and the executives in charge of the military. So how would that be enforced? That's my question.
Yeah, that's a great question, Dan. So let's say that, and I've seen stories where Republicans are worried about the power of Congress after the November midterms. And if Democrats were to take control and they were to use their congressional power of the purse, even just to rein in the costs and constrain the use of military in Iran, what sort of enforcement would be available against the president's continued use of the military, Professor Schultz?
That's a great question. So I'm going to approach it in a couple of different ways. First, it would be the courts are probably precluded at that point. As I mentioned to you, The courts don't want to get involved in these fights between Congress and the president. The second would be, and this is a declining option anymore, is that if the president truly defied Congress on a matter like this and disobeyed the law, this is what impeachment is supposed to be for at that point. But as we've seen, impeachment throughout American history has largely not been an effective tool against the president of the United States. We've had several impeachments, no convictions. And so that really becomes a great question that you ask here. I think it has to go to the power of the purse. It's going to have to be where Congress puts the president on an exceedingly short list or short leash, I should say leash, in terms of how money can be spent. But I think it also has to be coupled with other things in terms of maybe limiting president's ability to declare national emergencies or invoke emergency powers. So it's a whole bunch of things.
But when it comes to that power of the purse, Professor Schultz, I'm thinking we are currently in a partial federal government shutdown. Uh-huh. And it was through the president's own pen that he was able to begin funding again Transportation Security Administration employees without any sort of congressional approval. So would he be able to use that same power of the presidential pen in order to overcome the power of the purse in Congress?
If the money's not there, the answer is no.
Okay.
I mean, partly how the president is doing it right now, and it's still questionable from a constitutional perspective, is that he's saying, I found some extra, I don't want to quite say, I found money in the crease of the couch, but I found some extra money and we're going to pay them. But my understanding is that the paychecks that went out last Friday are the last ones, and there's no more money out there until Congress acts. And so if Congress were to put very tight restrictions on how money could be used and for what purposes, then that would be a potential tool that Congress could do and not give the president discretion to say, I'm going to move money from soup to nuts or something like that.
Sure, Dan, I think it's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it. We'll go to Todd in Madison next. Todd, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You partially answered my question. What powers Congress has, and it seems like the only powers they have is the purse or impeachment. Now, what about if a president openly defies a court order? Is there any, what powers do they have against that?
Well, a couple things here. First, if the president openly defies a court order, Congress still has the power of impeachment. But the other thing is that in theory, the president could be held in contempt of court. Although if we look at the Supreme Court decision, Trump versus the United States from a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court largely said that presidents acting within their authority can't be held criminally responsible. But I'm going to give a different option now.
Okay,
whole different option. I did a piece in the Los Angeles Times last, I think, November or so, but I can't remember the exact date. And when people said, well, what's going to happen if the president defies court orders? And I said, you might not be able to go after the president, but you can go after the president's attorneys. And now, remember, I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, where we've seen for the last couple of months, 3 months, a significant escalation of ICE. And several of the judges, federal judges here, have noted what one of them said over 100 times that ICE has defied court orders. And what you could start to do now is to say that, well, the court orders are going to go to let us say, lower officials.
Oh, I believe we just lost the connection with Professor Schultz. We'll get him back. But while we are reconnecting with David Schultz, I just want you to know that we have his War Powers fact sheet up on our website, or we'll have that after the show, at WPR.org/Larry. That's WPR.org/Larry. And he's got a list of everything that goes from Congress to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution to the War Powers resolution from 1973 and to aspects that we will be getting to next, and how this is all led almost in full circle from when our forefathers created the Constitution and wanted to get away from a king's ability to wage war as a singular person making the decision, to dividing the war powers among the Articles 1 and 2 in the Constitution, with a commander-in-chief and Congress being able to declare war, which hasn't been done since World War II, we have increasingly found the argument of, I will call it, a unitary executive power, where the president is able to use the military without congressional approval, which is exactly what we've seen now. But as Professor Schultz pointed out earlier, it is a continuation, perhaps different in scope, than what we saw with the use of drones during the Obama administration and what we've seen with troops in Somalia under the Biden administration. That none of this was done with congressional approval, but also, for some, there is an argument to be made for a strong unitary executive at this time, especially considering the inability of Congress to act in some way. So I believe we've got Professor Schultz back with us by phone. Professor Schultz, are you there?
I am there, and sorry, isn't technology wonderful?
We just did an hour on technology, and no, it is not.
Okay. Yeah. Anyhow, what I was saying before I got cut off here is that you know, lawyers are licensed at the state level, subject to disciplinary proceedings, and what we're starting to see now is that disciplinary bodies across the country, whether it's, well, hypothetically, it could be Wisconsin or Minnesota or wherever like that, now are taking actions against subordinates or the lawyers. And so that would be the other option at this point, is that you go after those people who are the subordinates or the lawyers who are basically telling the president, go do these illegal things.
Professor Schultz, there is an argument to be made for a strong executive branch of government, and part of that argument has to do with the inability of a congressional branch of government to act. So how do you see the other side of this argument making a case for the rise of, as you referred to it, the imperial presidency?
A couple ways to think about it. I mean, if we were to look at, for example, a picture or a graph and look at for the last 30 years or 40 years, we've become a much more polarized country in the last 30 to 40 years. We can also look at, with the exception of Roosevelt during the New Deal, which was kind of an unusual set of circumstances here, is that the number of executive orders has dramatically risen also in the last 30 years. So think about this. Polarization has increased. Congress is passing less and less legislation now than it used to before, and presidents are now issuing more executive orders. They're all interrelated. As our country and as Congress has become more divided,
Power doesn't disappear. The way I describe it to my students, power is like a water balloon. You squeeze it in one place and it goes somewhere else. And so as Congress is no longer able to get its job done, it's forcing presidents to act. Additionally, and this is the story that takes us from Roosevelt to the present, that over time, Congress has conceded or ceded more power to the presidency. We basically, Congress is saying, well, we're not going to resolve this matter ourselves. We're going to create a presidential some agency in the executive branch, such as the EPA or something else, to do this stuff. And so this is what I was talking about in class today before this program went on, as I was telling my students that over time, Congress has just given more and more authority to the president. At the same time, it's unable to get anything done because of the polarization. And so the president has basically filled in the vacuum. There's several of us out here who have made the argument that one of the best things that would ever happen is if Congress would basically say along the lines that we're going to take back some of this power. We're going to make the decisions ourselves and not have the president do it. And so that's how I would answer that question here, is that, yes, presidents do need to act in some emergencies, but for the most part, there's the number of real emergencies is really small, and Congress could, if it want, legislate to address those true emergencies.
And Professor, up to this point, we have been talking civics, not politics, specifically civics and what the Constitution says and what the courts have said and the division of powers of war between the executive branch and the congressional branch. But it would seem to me that if you were talking about Congress trying to claw some powers back, that it would very easily enter into the political fray, that it would more than likely have to be the opposing party or different parties between Congress and the executive branch to do it. But if it were to be done successfully, that if they were to share the powers once again or to reclaw some powers from Congress, it would likely have to be done for the sake of civics between the same party, either both Democrats or both Republican, because if it were one or the other, it would be excused away as pure politics.
You're right, and also because I suspect most presidents would then also want to veto any efforts to take away some of that delegated power, which means you have to overcome it. I mean, I point out to people, this is not impossible. You know, people forget that post-Watergate, Congress rose to the occasion. Congress passed some amazing legislation, the War Powers Act. It also passed what was called the 1974 Budget Act, which tried to take away the ability of presidents to impound or refuse to spend money. It also reformed what was called the ability of presidents to be able to issue emergency orders. And people forget, it was post-Watergate, it also imposed some campaign finance reform regimes. Now, I mention that because it did act at one point. Now, what's turned out over a 50-year period is that presidents have figured out ways to get around it, or the legislation hasn't caught up. But at one point, remember, Congress put country ahead of party. I mean, it was, I point out to my students that after the House Judiciary Committee bipartisanly voted to impeach the president, and before the actual full vote came in the House, Republican Senator Barry Goldwater went to Richard Nixon, a member of Republican, and said, "You better resign, because if this comes over to the Senate, you do not have the votes to survive." And so we had a point in American history, you know, 50 years ago, where what? Party was subordinate to country. And that becomes the challenge right now, is that it's really become what? Country second, party first. And this is, I also tell my students, what I think is the greatest, maybe one of the greatest presidential speeches ever given, was when Washington was ready to leave office in 1796. He's seeing the rise of the two major political parties occur. And he talks about how that if this happens, this is going to be bad for the country. And he says they're going to put party first, country second. I think George got it right. And so to me, we need to figure out how do we get those priorities back to where it's country first, party second.
But in my experience, Professor Schultz, it's by and large, we the people who will put country first and party second, and it is the people we elect that largely put party first and country second. And there seems to be a vast disconnect there somewhere that we just cannot or haven't been able to reconnect since the end of the Nixon administration.
I think you're right, although we have pretty good evidence, too. I think that we have become even more polarized as a public here. The way I describe it, if I were in my classroom, I say if we go back to the 1970s, let's just say 1976, make it even 50 years ago. If we plotted American public opinion out on a board, it would look like a bell-shaped curve. The vast majority of the public was in the center. The two political parties had moderates, liberals, and conservatives in both parties. But now American public opinion looks like a bimodal curve where the percentage of the Americans that describe themselves as being centrist has gone down. And the centers of the parties have moved further and further apart. And the parties have ideologically sorted themselves out to a large extent. And so to a large extent, also, we can say is that our Congress, to some extent, reflects the shift in American public opinion to where we in our parties, we're much more polarized. Again, still another way of describing it here is that 50 years ago, you would have what? We would have a situation where the ideology of Republican and Democratic parties overlap. Now they don't. Now, I can give a Minnesota example that'll help here. Is that in 1986, we elected a pro-life Democrat, Rudy Perfitch, to be governor, who was replaced 4 years later by a pro-choice Republican, Arnie Carlson. What do you think the chances are in Minnesota, Wisconsin, that we'd ever see that happen again? Yeah. It's gone. So that's how we've sorted our state out. And in Wisconsin, the same thing has happened, too.
Our guest, Professor David Schultz, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at Hamline University, Law Professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, and Professor at the Lithuanian Military Academy, also the author of a constitutional law textbook. In case you haven't noticed, he knows. And we'll have your questions next for him at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. So mark your calendars for tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. when online at WPR.org/presents. Tickets are first available for Larry Mueller's final garden talk live at Bayfield in Bloom. It's not his final garden talk. It's his final trip to Bayfield for Bayfield in Bloom, where he'll be broadcasting garden talk live Friday, May 29th. Those tickets are going to go fast and won't be available for very long, but they do become available tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. So when you're thinking about it, go grab yourself a pair and find Larry there Friday, May 29th at Bayfield and Bloom, online at WPR.org/presents. A week from tomorrow, he'll be at the Pablo Center in Eau Claire, Tuesday, May 20th at the Widener Center in Green Bay, and Wednesday, June 3rd at the Barrymore Theater in Madison. All those tickets are free and online at WPR.org/presents. If you plan on seeing Larry at any of those, make sure you get your tickets before you go, please. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And our guest is the Distinguished Professor David Schultz, taking a look at presidential powers. And let's get right back to your questions next. Chris and Fairchild, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sirs. First off, I would like to state that my interpretation is that this is an adversarial regime to the rule of law and constitutionality. And I typically look to groups like the Society for the Rule of Law or other groups such as Lawfare to kind of put together spreadsheets to kind of help visualize where the main thrusts of what this regime, if you will, is making their efforts in defiance of both constitutionality, the rule of law, both domestically and internationally. There was a judge in Minnesota recently put out something like 300 separate violations of defiance of court orders. So if there's an outlet out there that you're aware of that help kind of defines this, I think as a citizen, it's helpful to be able to visualize where it is that their intent is to attack. Other than just telling us that they're in charge, we need to see and be able to visualize where they're attacking to where we can move our chess pieces on the board appropriately.
Well, that does raise a question about whether or not this is a nation of laws or a nation of men, Professor Schultz, and whether or not that pendulum may be swinging in direction away from the rule of law, including all of us.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think this is one of the concerns that we have seen, again, and it's not just the Trump administration. I mean, if we look at, for example, a variety of measures, for example, the Freedom House, which measures democracy across the world, you know, every year they come up with a new ranking here. They have noted, you know, for several years, the erosion of democratic norms in the United States. They give us a score of an 84 out of 100. Now, in my game, as a teacher, 84 is a B. That's not okay, but not great. That's not great.
Right.
The Economist has said that we are a challenged democracy. Mm. I mean, so even prior to the Trump administration, there has been a variety of things in terms of what the polarization, our increased intolerance on both sides for disagreement and dissent. And then I still put pretty high up on the list here the fact that the gap between the rich and poor in America is at a level we've not seen ever in American history. Huh. There's a lot of stuff that's challenging, and then the role of money in politics. We're seeing lots of things that are challenging our democracy, but there are many who are concerned right now, and I think rightfully so, that the rule of law is being challenged in very profound ways that we've not seen in many, many years.
And one of those ways, as you mentioned, Professor Schultz, could be financially challenged?
Yes, in terms of financially challenging. What I mean by that is a couple of different things, is that we have, as a result of several court cases, an incredible ability for money to be able to impact our political system. And one could argue that for the average voter, they might feel like their vote pales in comparison to, you know, what rich people get to say or the influence they have in our society. What does that say about rule of law in America? And so, there's lots of different aspects to this story here, Hob. I did a piece about, again, last year that came out in the Minnesota Bench and Bar, which is kind of the newspaper for like lawyers. And I was called a second bill of particulars and said that if our Declaration of Independence was all about the bill of particulars that we had regarding the King of England abusing our rights, I said that we ought to be thinking about how there are many things now that strong presidents are doing that also look like a lot of what we fought a revolutionary war against 250 years ago.
Wow. I appreciate that perspective. Chris, thank you so much for the phone call. Let's go to John in Appleton next. John, good afternoon.
Lee, thank you for your program. And Professor, thanks for your service. So race relations in our country precipitated the need for more executive action back into the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You know, I hope you agree with that statement. That's what got the whole thing kicked off because, like the previous guest said, previous caller said, people put their own politics above the country. And, you know, that I think is the clearest example of that. I'm a proponent of socialism, of the book that John Nichols wrote, The S Word, which cites people like Thomas Paine, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr. I'd like the professor's thoughts about, you know, the need for federalism because states weren't willing to move and were prejudiced against non-white people, which makes me angry as a white person. And I would like his thoughts about an evolution toward socialism in the truest sense, not in the accepted sense that puts it close to communism, which it isn't. So I'd like your thoughts about that. And thanks for the show.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Professor?
Okay, so So let me start with the federalism issue, is that, you know, the federalism issue is, first off, is a problem that's been with us from the very start of our country, you know, which is how much authority to the national government versus to the state governments. And we've never solved that problem in American history. Now, when I think about, you know, historically, people will want to say, well, we don't want states to be able to sort of second guess or to basically impede the federal government. You know, a lot of people have in mind, for example, the civil rights movement, you know, the images of Southern recalcitrance and Southern defiance of civil rights laws. And so on the one hand, the whole argument about states' rights conjures up racism, bigotry, and so forth. But at the same time, and again, if I can, you know, again, you know, I'm over in Minneapolis, St. Paul right now. I'm hearing a bunch of people who are talking about saying that, listen, right now the national government is the government that we don't like, and we want to defend states' rights to protect states from the federal government doing nasty things. And so I say this because I think we have kind of a love-hate relationship with federalism. We love states when it's for our ideology, and we hate states when they're opposing it. And again, if we think about what our framers were worried about, abuse of power. Again, remember, I write the word fear on the board. It's not just about the abuse by the president, but it's abuse of power or fear of power of any one person, department, or even level of government. Our constitutional system was designed not to be efficient with a capital E, but what? It's basically to restrain abuses of power. And sometimes we get upset by the fact that, what? Maybe we can't push this legislation through. We just can't do what we want. But if we get to do it, the next president or the next Congress gets to do it. So it's supposed to be a somewhat cumbersome process in terms of legislating. So that's sort of my thought on the federalism issue. In terms of the issue about socialism, this becomes really sort of a matter of ideology and politics and how you define socialism also too. Is socialism about what? The democratization of the economic sphere? Is socialism about people's voice in the matter? Is it about providing more benefits for people? I mean, a lot depends on how people interpret what their image of what socialism is. And so I leave that to the listeners in terms of their definition.
I appreciate that. And from my perspective, you know, socialism is a political thing, but we're talking about civics here. And when it comes to our government, we're trying to figure out what we're willing to pitch in and pay for and how in the fairest way possible we're going to pitch in and pay for it. And that would include, to some degree, our use of the military. We've mentioned the power of the purse lying in the hands of Congress and whether or not Congress would have the intent to use that power or is willing to continue to forego that power. And as you mentioned, Professor Schultz, that power doesn't go away. It just transfers someplace else, and most recently into the hands of the executive branch of government. Let's go to Robert in Amherst Junction next. Robert, good afternoon.
Hi there. So my question to the professor is, things changed dramatically with Reagan. And the Reagan administration, He made it clear that government was the enemy. And that has kind of evolved over time, where now Trump is able to show that anything he can do is justified because he's, I don't know, anti-government somehow.
Even though he is the government, which is hard to circle that square, Professor Schultz.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I think Trump is both anti-government and pro-government at the same time. And I think Reagan was in the same way, too. But here is that we saw this, especially in Trump's first term, is that he wants to use government to achieve certain types of objectives, but at the same time, he also, and again, we saw in this term here when he first started off, wants to dismantle parts of government. And that's a fundamental contradiction here, that the Trump presidency has never resolved, is how to both be anti-government but move your agenda, political agenda, at the same time. And I think the Trump presidency is exactly in that situation right now, too.
And Professor Schultz, as Robert Menson's President Reagan, you talked about how Congress rose up after Nixon and Watergate and took back control and regained some power in the balance of power between the branches of the federal government. But the argument would be made that we began to see that unitary executive or imperial presidency rise again at some point during the Reagan administration.
You're absolutely correct at that point, is that we could – Carter was a relatively weak president for a lot of reasons, but Congress started to, at that point, give the president much more authority. And we could actually start to chart out that by the time we got to the 80s, we started to see this significant polarization occurring, to where it's like, well, he's my guy, it's okay, or he's not my guy, it's not okay.
Right.
And again, really, really sort of the takeoff and polarization does occur and start in the 80s. Now, there is another theory that's out there, and this is kind of hard to figure out here. Was America polarizing at that point? Or was it the fact that eventually the rise of the new media and now the social media has led us to become polarized? Or does the fractured media environment just reflect this polarization? And scholars have not resolved that out. But certainly your point that by the 80s, we already started to see the Reagan era, whatever bipartisanship we saw that was there in the post-Watergate, it had started to evaporate pretty significantly by the early to mid 80s, and certainly really takes off during the 90s, during the Clinton presidency.
Robert, great point, and I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you for calling. I only have a few minutes left here, but I do want to ask about the allegations or accusations of war crimes against a president. When President Trump goes on his social media to say he's going to destroy a civilization, when he threatens bridges and power plants, are there such things as war crimes in this current era? And if so, are they enforceable?
Well, you raise a different question. We've been talking about domestic law, but if we now bring in international law, we have a whole different game out here, is that the entire framework of international law discourages the use of any forms of aggression for the purposes of trying to settle any type of disputes. And we're supposed to go through what the International Court of Justice, through the UN, through the Security Council, on top of which the UN at one point, actually not the UN, I should say, the international community adopted a treaty on genocide that basically says advocating the destruction of a group or of a civilization intentionally is genocide. And so if we look at statements, the most famous one of Trump's recently, destroy a civilization,
yeah,
or something like that, that gets pretty close to what an international law definition would be regarding genocide, which would be illegal under international law.
Yeah, but is that ever enforceable? I think the same allegations were made against Kissinger with Vietnam and others since. But if you don't leave, how does that ever come to pass? And we've got about a minute left here.
Sure. Well, we also created in the late 90s, early 2000s, an international criminal court, because international law was always set up around countries. Now we can hold individuals responsible, it's up to countries to enforce. And by the way, we as the United States have said we're not going to recognize the jurisdiction of the international criminal court. But technically, if Trump were indicted for war crimes and he were to travel to another country that was a signatory of what's called the Rome Treaty, they could actually detain him and turn him over to an international criminal court.
Professor Schultz, I want to thank you so much for your time and wisdom this afternoon, and I hope very much that we have this opportunity to do it again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
A discussion in civics today that takes a look at the powers of the president, the war powers as they are decided by our forefathers and as they stand today with our military strikes in Iran, and the power of the U.S. Constitution as it currently stands, as well as a little bit of the international courts. Professor Schultz, distinguished professor of political science and legal studies at Hamline University, law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, and professor at the Lithuanian Military Academy. I want to thank the Larry Mueller team for having me sit in for Larry today, who is back tomorrow. Executive producer Jill Nadeau, Joe Patenaude, Clara Nypert, Jeff Robbins, thanks to all of them. I am Lee Rayburn sitting in for Larry today. And don't forget, your Larry Live from Bayfield tickets are available tomorrow morning starting at 8 a.m. at WPR.org/presents. And Professor Schultz's War Powers fact sheet will be up on our website after the show today as well. That'll be at WPR.org/Larry. Stay with us. We've got lots more in store.